Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30, so I think I will stop the share. Oh, I'll leave this slide up. We've got all kinds of new presentations that are now set for 2025, first 3 months, so if anybody's interested in any of those, they're all up on our website. They won't be up on the Ottawa Public Library website for probably another week or two before they start appearing there.
Oh, are you ever busy?
Yes, we are. Okay, so it is just past 7:30, so I'm going to mute all. And as usual, you'll have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a comment or question, remute yourself afterwards so you keep background noise to a minimum. Welcome to all members and guests. And as always, we welcome guests anytime at meetings of the Ottawa PCUs group. If you want to join our happy little band, I have pasted into the chat. You can link, go to the link for join or renew, or if you just go to our homepage on the website, there is a link at the top for join or renew. It's only $20 a year, and we'd be happy to have you join us. So with that, we do have a fairly full agenda tonight, so I think I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris, and we'll get right to it. I've got to start on a tech video, which I came across recently. This is one of these historical ones. It's actually quite interesting. The guy's doing the history of software in acronyms. So there are A and B and C, et cetera, but the one I found was G is for GNU. And, of course, that interests me because I'm interested in GNU Linux. So the highlights, this guy is called Dylan Beatty. He's a very good speaker. As I said, the presentation is G for GNU. And GNU is one of these weird acronyms, recursive acronym, where GNU actually stands for GNU is not Unix. And in the presentation, he talks about the story about Xerox giving a laser printer to MIT, which kept jamming all the time. And the programmer there, by the name of Richard Stallman, who's the open source guy, he wanted to modify the code so it would send him an email when it jammed, so somebody could go and fix it. He actually wanted to send an email to everybody who was using the printer, and then the person who was nearest would go and fix the paper jam. But Xerox wouldn't give him the source code. It was proprietary. And that set off the whole free software, open source software, and the GNU project. And he started off with these so-called four essential freedoms, which I really like this story. They're labeled freedom 0 to freedom 3. And that's, if you're not aware of that, that's a programmer's joke, because arrays in some programming languages often start at element 0 rather than element 1. So the four essential freedoms are 0 to 3 rather than 1 to 4. Now, we have to be a programmer to understand that, or appreciate it, I guess. He talks about the GPL, the General Public License. Linus Torvalds is mentioned. He, of course, produced the kernel, which was the one missing piece from the whole GNU project. And also mentions Christine Peterson, who apparently was the first person to talk about free software as being open source. So that's where that term originated from, apparently. And the GPL, of course, is a license, so you're allowed to modify the code, but if you release that code, then you have to release your modifications in full under the same terms as the GPL. And there have been a couple of lawsuits, at least, on that. One of them involved this Linksys router that was purchased. Linksys was purchased by Cisco, and Cisco eventually made the software, released the software, because it was built on some of the GNU stuff, some of the open source software. But there was a lawsuit because they were taking their time doing it, and eventually that got settled out of court. But apparently there is one in Germany that actually went to trial, and the judge found in favor of the GPL. So there's a precedent for open source and GPL. And my favorite bit of the whole video is why is it GNU? Why is it GNU and not XNU? And X is not Unix. Which if you look at that, that's Unix backwards. Anyway, you have to watch the video to figure that one out. It's really quite interesting. If you're at all interested in open source software, it's well worth 15 or 16 minutes, whatever it is, worth watching. Okay, next up we have Chris, who has a different take on artificial intelligence, I think.
And you're going to give me control of the slides?
I will do that, yes.
So just a little bit of backstory on this one here. I was giving a presentation for the National Capital Freenet on my one on password managers, and I was wondering if they were actually promoting this very much, and I couldn't find anything on the NCF website, and so I decided I would ask Perplexity AI, is the National Capital Freenet holding a workshop on password managers, because maybe they found it when I couldn't. And the answer came back that, yes, they're indeed holding a workshop on password managers, and they tell you all about what it's going to be about, and then recommend checking on the website for further details. And so I ended up responding to them, and because I couldn't find it on the NCF website, so I said, well, can you tell me where you found out about that? And it came back saying that, well, it was not found in the provided search results, and again, recommending that I go to the NCF website. So I complained a little bit about that and said I couldn't find anything about the workshop on the NCF website. Please tell me where you found out about it, as they detailed on the first slide. And they apologized, and they could not find any specific information indicating that is the NCF is holding a workshop. And so they are lying liars who lie, because in the first round they said that NCF is indeed holding a workshop focused on password managers. So one of those hallucinations that you occasionally come across with AI. So just an amusing little tidbit. And I think the next one is mine too. So, yeah, so this is the, I had to chuckle at this one here, latest surveillance threat is air fryers. Well, it turns out that there are some air fryers that have a phone app that you can install, and I guess you can speak to it and tell it to do something, turn on or turn off, or time it to come on at a certain time, or things like that through the phone app. And it turns out that the phone apps wanted permissions that were a little bit surprising. They want to know the customer's precise location. Not sure why they would need to do that. Permission to record audio. I suppose that's so you could actually, by voice, tell the air fryer what to do or things like that. And two of the air fryers specifically were sending personal data to Chinese servers, much to surprise of some people, I guess. And the recommendation is that you question the permission. Any app that you install on your phone, check what permissions it's asking for and see, does this really make sense that this app really needs those permissions? Read the privacy policy, although they are not beholden to their privacy policy, I suppose. And then ask yourself if the appliance actually needs to be smart, or maybe you can just push the buttons on the front of it. And the easy solutions, don't install the app. Don't provide personal data that they don't need to know. And the URL is there if you want to read the whole article, and it's pasted into the chat.
And the next one's yours too, Chris.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this one, I had to get a chuckle out of this one too. It was interesting. I stumbled across it and I thought, no, this must be clickbait, that they're just trying to trick you into clicking on something that will lead you to something that is completely other than what the story is about. So this was titled as Lava Lamps Are Keeping the Internet Secure. And the backstory on this is that in order to generate unpredictable seeds for encrypting things over the internet, you need random numbers. And it's really, really hard to actually generate truly random numbers. Most computer-generated random numbers are pseudo-random, but they are all based on a seed that might be, you know, the time of day or the day or something like that, and it's not truly random. And Cloudflare, who does an awful lot of the load balancing of traffic over the internet, they actually use Lava Labs, about 100 of them, to generate random number seeds. What they have is a wall full of these lava lamps, and so, of course, the patterns are completely random, and they take pictures of it, and then they analyze the picture for various areas, how bright it is, and colors and things like that, and they use that total random data to actually generate random number, or the seed for encryption. And they actually have some other ones as well. They have one where there's 100 mobiles that are just blown in the breeze in the place where they have them, and they do a similar thing where they take a picture of it, and then they look for brightness patterns and things like that. And they have a bunch of pendulums that run constantly, and those random movements are used to generate the seeds for encryption. But that was kind of interesting, and the URL is there, and in the chat if you want to read more on it.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. Tom's been posting something in about something similar there, so there is stuff in the chat on that. Okay, next up we have another episode in my Training Up to Linux mini-series. And you may remember that this is all due to the fact that Windows 10 is going to reach end of life in next October. And some of us don't have machines that will upgrade to Windows 11, so we're having to think about what to do in the next year. One of my philosophies, or one of my strategies, is to actually use Linux a lot more. And so I've been looking at how do you install Linux and how do you customize the desktop. It turns out you end up, if you install Linux, you end up with a very stark, plain desktop. But you can configure that desktop pretty well the same way that you can by using on-screen icons and things on the taskbar, icons on the taskbar, just as you can in Windows. So last time we were looking at how to add software icons, programs to the desktop and the panel. And this time, well, I wanted to ask to answer the question, well, what happens if you have some software that doesn't have anything in the menu, so you can just right-click on it and add it to the desktop, for example? So, for example, here's a couple of icons which run software if I double-click on it, but it's actually being run by a program launcher. So we're going to have a look at how you develop program launchers. But before that, if anybody's been paying attention to this series at all, you will recognize that on this screen, there is something that is trying to attract my attention. So the question is, this is your homework, and what is it that I should be paying attention to on this screen? So anybody wants to put that in the chat, and we'll come back to that later on. I might mention that these restart and shutdown icons are something that I developed way back a few years ago when I bought my first computer that had Windows 8, and I couldn't figure out how to turn it off. And then there was a series of things you had to do to find the power switch, as it were, the software power switch in Windows 8. But it turned out there was a program that you could actually run and do the job for you. So somewhere in the archives of the newsletters is an article on how to do that. But I've used the same technique on all of my computers since, both in Windows and also, as you're going to see in a second, you can do the same thing in Linux. Because like Windows, Linux has a shutdown program, and you can essentially give commands to either shut down the computer, like right now, or restart or reboot the computer, which is very useful. When you have a dual boot system, if you want to go from Linux to Windows, all you do is just double click on this restart button, and then when the grub menu comes up, you choose the other operating system to boot into. The program is stored in the SBIN folder, And it's actually owned by Root. It's not owned by me as a regular user. It's owned by the super user, which is not, who's normally called Root. And here's one of the tricks in Linux. Is I've said mostly that in almost all situations, you don't have to use the terminal to use Linux. But it turns out I can't find a way to do this particular command in a graphical user interface. So I only know how to do it in terminal. But if you check on Mr. Google, he'll tell you how to do it. And if you want to run programs as a regular user and not have to use the sudo prefix, the super user do prefix, then, and especially for this command where I want to set the SUID permission bit, the super user ID permission, I have to give it this command, this change mode command. And I mean, how do I remember that? Well, a long time ago also, Chris and I did a thing on modifying your computer when you first make it, first start it, and I'd said that one of the things you should do is maintain keep up a maintenance log. Now, at the top of the log, you put in things like serial numbers and activation codes for Microsoft Office and that kind of thing, so you always know where they are at the top of the file. And then you have a maintenance log as to what you've installed and how you've tweaked it. And here's the thing, I always do go through this series of commands or series of processes when I install a new version of Linux. And every time there's a major release of Linux, I do a completely fresh install and then set things up using this file. And you can see I've got the instructions here to add the launchers for shutdown and restart. There's the commands and where I get the icons from and so forth. So this is the command. Sudo, as I said, is the super user do command. It says run the command as the root, and you have to give it a password to allow it to do that. Change mode is change the file permissions, or change the permissions on a file. And then u plus s is the owner of the file is root, right, because we're doing this shutdown program. We want to add a permission, and the permission we want to add is s, which is to set the set UID bit. And then we have to tell it which program it is and where it lives, and it lives in the sbin folder, and it's called shutdown. And so once we've done that, then we can allow this program to run just as a regular user. So what I have to do is basically call up the terminal, and that's an icon on the panel, the taskbar, and it's like running a command window in Windows 10. So you just type in the command on you. In my case, I cut and paste it from my maintenance log file, run that program. It asks me for my user password and then basically runs it and doesn't give any feedback. It just happens. All right, so now I've set shutdown so I can run it as a regular user. Now what I want to do is right-click anywhere on the desktop, anywhere, any blank space on the desktop, and I want to select this create a new launcher, create a program launcher on the desktop. When I do that, when I get a dialog box, I can call this program or this launcher anything I want. The name is going to be the text that's associated with the icon. The important thing is to give it the right command. So here's where I cut and paste my command from the maintenance log. And then before I say OK, you notice here we've got this weird icon which has got nothing to do in my view with shutting down things. So I actually want to click on that, and that will launch a file manager. And I could choose from some of these categories on the left here, but I actually want to browse my file system and basically find on my data disk, find this desktop images folder where I have desktop images, where I have this file called shutdown.png. So if I select that that image, then it shows up in the file manager here. I have to click on it to select it, and then that enables these buttons down the bottom here and I can just say select this image, and now that image is that shutdown.png is associated with this launcher. So I say OK, and it says, would I like to add the launcher to the menu? So I'll have shutdown and restart options in my menu once I've gone through this whole process. So I can say, yes, I want to do that. And I would get the, sorry, I would get the shutdown icon on my desktop. And here I've just dragged it over to the bottom right-hand corner. And you'll see I've also done the same thing, and I've created another launcher for restart. And so I've got the restart and shutdown icons now on my desktop. So that's what you would do if you had a program that wasn't available in your menu, and to create an icon on the desktop to launch that program. And here is my, this is basically my working desktop as it happens right now. There's some of the stuff we did last week. Here are the various drives that we installed, we added to the desktop. Here's the icons down here that we've just created. And up top here, you'll see that there's a bunch of icons on the left there, which you'll recognize as Microsoft Office, got Word and Excel and PowerPoint. And on the right-hand side, there's a program called HomeSite. All of these programs are Windows programs, but I'm running them in Linux. This is the Linux desktop. I've got icons to run the programs. And when I run them, I'm running Windows programs in Linux. So that's what we're going to be looking at next week, because, you know, some of us can't leave Windows behind completely. So we're going to take a look at how do we run Windows programs in Linux. So did anybody answer my question, Chris?
Yes, there were a couple. Virus protection, ? You have a dot on the shield icon, So three people that identified that.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at right here. If you remember, that was the that's the software manager icon. And when there's a yellow dot there, it means that there are software updates available. So I would basically click on this and see what was available and then install those updates. So well done, people. I'm glad to see people are paying attention to my presentation. Okay, up to you, Chris, next.
Okay, we're actually going to do a tag team on this one here. Thunderbird for Android. So I've used Thunderbird email for a long time on my desktop and laptop Windows computers, and I really like it as an email client. They did not have a version for Android. I have an Android phone, and I was always looking forward to that. And so instead I used a program called K9 for my OPCU Gmail on Android. And that's actually a Gmail account that we get complimentary accounts on that from Google. Let me paste this into the chat while I'm thinking about it. Whole bunch of links on here. Okay, so so K9, it's got a long history behind it. It was first released in 2008. It was actually listed as best app for sending email in a physical book back in 2010. It was acquired by Mozilla, makers of the Thunderbird, in 2022. And I thought, oh, this is great. So we are going to end up with, they're going to rejig it, and they're going to make a Thunderbird client for Android. And it then began a very slow transition. So keep in mind, that was 2022 that they came out with that. And lo and behold, on October 30th of this year, it was finally available as Thunderbird for Android 8.0. So they jumped all the way up to 8. And it is free and open source. So, you know, the question is, should K9 users migrate over to be using Thunderbird for Android? And quite frankly, I didn't see any really significant changes. Alan will have some changes that he noticed, but I didn't see anything really significant. But I didn't really go looking bit for bit on it on each of the screens. It is very easy to set up. If you're coming from Thunderbird on desktop, you can do it through using a QR code, or you can do a file export. So it can, with a QR code, you just scan the code and basically bang, it'll set up all the accounts properly. If you want to do it from K9 on Android directly, so this is not necessarily doing it as an upgrade or anything like that, or not transferring from your Thunderbird configuration at all, it's also pretty easy to actually go through. And setting up brand new accounts and so forth, or additional accounts, is pretty straightforward. So the question is, should new users try Thunderbird for Android? You know, I find it to be a good mail program for sure, so I would say without hesitation that I think it's a good program for people to use. The question is K9 going to go away? And the answer is no. In this Reddit post from a month ago, the response from the question, when will K9 mail be abandoned, said no, it's not going to be abandoned, and they are going to keep it around for a really long time. And they say, at this point, K9 and Thunderbird for Android are really the same app, just a different theme about it. So that for what it's worth. Or maybe it's yes, because this from a post back in 2022, what will happen to K9 Mail once the official Thunderbird for Android app has been released? And this from one of the programmers at Thunderbird, we plan to continue maintaining and releasing K9 for approximately 1 year. After the release of Thunderbird for Android. So I guess the answer is maybe. Will I continue using it? Yeah, I will. Basically, to me, it's no significant difference from K9. I'm suspecting that at some point they are going to give up on K9 and they are going to tell everybody they have to move over to using Thunderbird for Android. I'm quite happy with it. Now, currently, I'm actually using the Gmail app for my regular Gmail address, and that's both on my phone as well as my Windows desktop and laptops. And I use Thunderbird for my OPC UG address, which, as I mentioned, is actually a Gmail account as well. And I use that on my phone as well as on my desktop and laptop Windows computers. I use Webmail for everything else. And I only use those from my desktop. I don't access these other email accounts from my phone, mostly test accounts. NCF email I have for a few low-priority distribution lists that I belong to, as well as I find it very useful for disposable email addresses. But the question is, or some people might say, well, Gmail app can actually pull email from a whole bunch of accounts, so why not use you know, just the Gmail. Why bother using Thunderbird on my phone, or for that matter, on my desktop Windows computers? And I prefer to actually keep my two main email accounts completely separate. I don't want to accidentally send from one account when I'm thinking I'm sending from another. So having that where I just know that my OPC UG account is Thunderbird, and the Gmail app is strictly for my other Gmail account helps keep things separate. So that's the way that I deal with it. And now I'm going to kick it over to Alan to talk about what he found about the upgrade to Thunderbird for Android.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. There was a comment from Stuart. He says, K9 won't go away as long as you walk it once a day.
Oh, we got the bad puns going on today.
And Carol wants to know, how is Thunderbird a Gmail account? And I said, well, it's not a Gmail account. No. It just can access Gmail accounts.
Yeah, exactly.
And Thunderbird is essentially a mail client, so it can access any email server, including Gmail.
Yeah.
I would agree with Chris. It's really easy to update K9 to Thunderbird. It's basically a one-click type operation. And as you said, they're essentially the same program right now. Some slight differences, but nothing really, I'd agree, there's nothing really major. But I have two issues. And one is that when I did update K9, just the feature update to K9 itself, I ended up with a really ugly dark brown button, which I really didn't like. But there was no way to change it. It wasn't configurable. I really don't like that. And it turns out switching between two different accounts, remember I just said Thunderbird and K9 can access multiple accounts. And I use two accounts on my system. But now I need to have an extra click to move between them, essentially. So this is what happens when, or this is what happened when I one day logged on and found that my K9 had automatically been updated. And you can see this ugly brown button for the inbox. And you probably can see there in the top left-hand corner, this is my mail server, my personal mail server. And this is the OPCUG, essentially a Gmail account because it's coming through the Google Group service. So I've actually got the two different accounts and I can switch between them. And the way I do that is the one at the top is my Alan and Carol account. But if I hit the OP button here, then it basically switches the two accounts. Octua PCUG comes to the top. And you probably notice here that the folders have changed. I've gone from archives and draft and sent to Outbox and Gmail drafts. But it's all black and white and it's just a list of folders. And to me, it doesn't kind of jump out at me and say, oh, you've just switched accounts. It's not terribly obvious. And before, when I would switch accounts, I would go from one inbox, I'd go straight to the other inbox. Well, now I have to click on OP to get it to the top here, and then I have to hit the inbox to open the inbox and actually see the messages that are in there. It's not a big deal, but it just needs getting used to, essentially. But the good news is that when I saw this and I decided, well, I'll see what Thunderbird itself has to do, so I installed Thunderbird in addition to K9 on my phone, and Thunderbird actually looked a little bit different. Still had the same two accounts, but that ugly brown button changes into a nice, pretty blue one. So, and this is what I'm using right now. I've actually switched to Thunderbird completely, and I've actually uninstalled K9, because, as I said, they're essentially the same program. So, there's absolutely no point in I don't see any point in keeping both of them. So, if you have been using K9, you might want to give Thunderbird a try. It sounds like we're going that way eventually anyway. Okay. Don't think there was anything else in the chat there.
Nope.
So now it's time to go to a grocery-related item, and we're going to call on Bob Harris. Bob, am I changing the slides for you? Wherever he is.
Sorry, yes, please, Alan. Please change the slides.
Okay.
And I get fired up here. Okay, we're on now. Thank you. So I'd like to encourage people. We've all been asked before, whatever you're using, please try and share it. So I've been using this since midsummer or so, and I'd like to share with you ManyPenny. It's a free Canadian smartphone app that'll revolutionize your grocery shopping. Go ahead, please. So, is it really a good deal? You're out shopping in the store. My slide didn't admit. Oh, sorry. No, we're still on number two now, I think. Number two, please, Alan. Is it really a good deal? Okay, sorry, I'm doing my slides here to follow the notes. So, have you folks ever bought something only to find out later that it wasn't a good deal? Now, I usually hear about this when I get home because my wife knows all of the prices, but I certainly don't. Now, some folks never know and some people don't care. But the stores do know that most shoppers tend to focus on the sale items. But once you're in the store, we pick up a lot of other things. Now, sometimes we get tricked by big displays and large signs. Next, please. So, introducing Many Penny, your pocket price checker. Now, Many Penny offers you real-time comparisons, and it helps you make smart, informed decisions instantly. Go ahead, please. So, how does it work? It's very simple. To use it, you install the app on your smartphone. You pick out your favorite local stores that you shop at. When you're shopping, you can pick up any item. You can scan it while shopping. And then you can instantly compare and check prices from the other stores. You can then decide if you want to buy the item. Go ahead, please. So right away, it instantly checks the prices from the stores that you have in your list. Now, it doesn't, right across Canada, doesn't matter whether you're in Ottawa, Vancouver, and yes, we have, I did check on this. It even has a large number of stores in Shawinigan. Now, apparently, it does offer historical price data and price alerts. I don't use these features. I'm a simple guy. I want it to be simple and work. Open my phone. I can scan it. It's simple and easy. So I looked at it. I didn't see it in there. So I can't tell you about the historical data. I don't know why I'd want that anyway. But for my stuff, it works great. And next slide, please. We're already on. That's good. Thank you. So Many Penny, it says, does respect your privacy. It only collects your email and name. It does not keep or store any location data. Now, this app was generated, made in Vancouver, came out in the beginning of 2024. I've had it since mid to late summer. Anyway, it's self-funded and it's ad-free. Now, all this sounds too good to be true. Apparently, it uses, from my research, it uses retail data. It checks or records the items that people have scanned without tying with this to your personal information. So some folks say that it's fine, but it only has my email and my name and whatever I scan. So let's move on and scan a given item here. Thank you. So this item, I won't go into details item by item, but this item, whatever it is, was available in 5 stores that I have saved. And I'd like to mention here that the lowest store or the highest store is not consistent. This is quite, it's all over the map. It's not always the same. And but anyway, so once you have this information, you're in the store, what can you do with it? And next slide, please. So, well, you can buy it or you can don't buy it. You can travel to a different store. You can decide that you want to pay more. But the point here is that you have all the information in less than 3 seconds. Now, I certainly don't scan every item. I don't scan all items. I may only scan a few. And sometimes I don't care what the price is. I'm picking it up. But I often leave the scanning function on my cell phone open while I'm shopping. You just grab the item and scan it and pop it back in and then go back to the beginning and put the item down. It's really, really quick. Now, since you're talking on this part here, some stores do not allow price matching. And the price matching usually only applies to advertised sale items. But the focus here is not so much on the advertised sale items, because the biggest difference you're going to save, yes, you're going to get those 2 or 5 things that you really saw in the sale flyer, but your cart is filled with a ton of other things. And you can type in the word chunky soup, whatever you're buying, or scan the code. You can do it from home also once it's set up on your phone. And anyway, and next slide here, please. So, Many Penny, it's a smart savings beyond flyers. This is part of their marketing stuff here. And once again, please, the Many Penny smartphone app is available on both platforms. You can go to the Google Play Store or the App Store. Now, I realize some folks here are going to say, oh no, I couldn't do that. A little apprehensive. I couldn't be doing that. And don't worry. You've got this. Next slide, please. With years of training at self-checkouts, we are all professional cashiers. You can do this. There's nothing to it. You pop this on your phone. It's simple. It's easy. It's quick. It's instant. It's free. It makes you into a smart shopper, well, just like Debbie. But and anyway, Many Penny, thank you for listening to this, folks. If you have something you have using yourself, please share it also. And Many Penny.
We have a couple of questions. We have Elizabeth wonders how Many Penny pays for its services if there's no ads. Do you have any idea how they actually pay for that?
Well, I did research that because, as they say, if it's free, the product is me.
Yeah.
And apparently it uses – I've researched this – that it uses the data. So if a lot of people are shopping – I don't know, they said Chuck E. Soup, whatever – whatever you're going, or you want potatoes, whatever. I don't know if that information is conveyed to the grocery stores or the Campbell Soup Company. I don't know who wants that information. But if you research it a bit, apparently it's crowdsourced and stuff. They must have some access to the stores because it's quite most everything is on your phone. It's rarely to find it. Now, it's primarily grocery stores. I haven't used it, but I put Home Depot and Home Hardware on my phone. I haven't really tried that part of it yet. But its function is grocery stuff. And unless you know all the prices, like it really, there's a lot of diversity in the prices. So you're in the store and you can see that it's going to be $2 more or less somewhere else, and do you want to buy it? And they say it's a good price. Is it a good price?
Yeah.
Because I've done it more than once. They have a big display. I bring this home, and look what I got. And Debbie says, oh, you idiot. This is sweet, but this should be only whatever. And well, I didn't know. So that's what got me to get this one here, because Debbie doesn't need the prices. She knows everything, remembers it, and I'm not quite up to that speed.
We have a question from Tom. Does it work with produce? I guess it needs a barcode, right?
No, you can type in the word grape or banana, whatever.
Okay.
But it has to have the exact same item to compare it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
interesting.
Anyway, it's free. Your camera's got a phone on it. You can scan that. And it's only available in Canada. Anyway, there's Canadian made app. I shouldn't say it's only available in Canada. I don't know that.
We have a question from Natalie. Does the price you see on the app relate to a specific store at a specific location?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Okay. So you actually tell it what locations you want to track?
Yes. One of the, I can't say this enough. I don't do complex things or whatever. I want simple, easy, and stuff. I didn't want to put a lot of work into this. But I have tried it for a while. So you install the app, and it'll say, I think it'll ask you where you live. And I picked some stores. We shop sometimes nearby here, No Frills and the Real Canadian Superstore. Well, I'm not going to drive to Orleans to get tomatoes.
Just save a buck.
So anyway, so it's only in your area. So then it'll automatically, once you have that, when you pick a certain item, you could be going for spaghetti, whatever. And it'll give you spaghetti prices, but it's got to be Catelli spaghetti, whatever that name. It won't match other brands.
Yeah.
But I can say it's amazingly fast. There's Tom, yeah.
Yes, I'd just like to say there's a guy on the Reddit Ottawa channel or whatever it's called. Does a weekly look at all the things that are on sale for all the stores, like, I don't know, about 15 stores, different stores.
Yeah, Bob's presented on that before.
Oh, and I just put a link in the he stopped and then he started again. So now I put a link. It's way up in the chat, but it's the longest link.
Well, that's interesting. Forgot the guy's name now. Jeez. anyway.
Hey, Romanker.
Pardon me?
His user ID on Reddit is Stromanker.
I think his name is Donovan. Is his name Donovan Burry? No, I'm not sure the last name. Sorry, Donovan for sure. Anyway, that sparked me to do that because he stopped doing that. And before I was doing it before, I could always pull my phone up and get the bulk of the things. But actually, that was the reason. When he stopped, I was forced to go somewhere else. So that's what sparked me to get back onto this. I didn't know he's doing it again.
Cool. Okay, thanks a lot, Bob.
Thank you, folks. Thank you.
Okay, Chris, so you're up next again.
Yes, I'm up. This is our last item, I think, on the night. So this is Complaint Part X, so Part 99 or 153 or something like that. I've often advocated complaining when something is not how you like it. And so this was from a 2020 Q&A session, and I talked about a few things that I had come across that I had reported, and there was some mix, a little bit of a mix on what was actually fixed and what wasn't. So the fancy zone one was, within 30 minutes of reporting, they thanked me for reporting it, and it was fixed. A whole bunch of stuff that I provided feedback through the Windows Feedback Hub, which I think is actually a little bit of a black hole that is just a void you throw comments into. But regardless, it looks like some of the things that I either reported on originally or upvoted, if somebody else had reported, eventually did get fixed. The not fixed one calculator, this is a bugaboo I have, where a lot of the Windows built-in apps are not following the Windows color scheme, and that really bugs the heck out of me. That's still not fixed. So those ones that are fixed, I like to think it was because it was my reporting, even though maybe that really wasn't the case, that it was me that did it, but I like to think that that's possibly a good thing. So just recently, I was prepping a share on vulnerability management, and I was testing a program called Sectier Vuln Detect. And this is if people have a long memory of Sikuni, a personal software inspector, that went completely just on the commercial side of things, and they dropped the free version of the program, and a bunch of the programmers from Sikuni actually left and they started Sectier, and they developed this program called Vuln Detect. And I had some things I didn't really like about the way that it worked, and they haven't really fixed a lot of them, but it is one of the best, I think, free vulnerability management programs out there. And while I was doing my testing, I all of a sudden had malware bytes pop up on my screen, and it was blocking something. And so it said website was blocked due to a compromise, and lo and behold, it was actually the Vuln Detect server that was being blocked, which sort of shocked me a little bit. And I thought there were two possibilities. It could be that the Vuln Detect server was actually compromised, and that's really bad for a security company to actually allow their web server or service that is exposed to the internet to become compromised. Or it could be a false positive in malware bytes. And false positives in anti-malware programs is not all that uncommon. So something had to be fixed and quickly. So if it was Vuln Detect that had a compromise on their server, it could be compromising every person who connects to that server. So there's no way to know if customers are actually being compromised because of this. Or if it's on the malware byte side, they needed to correct a false positive because anybody who is using both malware bytes and Vuln Detect, well, the Vuln Detect client on the computer can't contact the backend server, and so there's some operation that is not happening correctly. So who to approach? So should I go to Sectier for the Vuln Detect side of things, or should I go to malware bytes, or should I go to both of them? And I thought it was much, much more likely that it was a false positive in malware bytes. So I figured, well, I'll start there. And if it turns out that it's not a false positive, then I will switch over to approaching Vuln Detect people. So I went to the malware bytes website, and they have a forum for reporting any kind of issues. And I searched around a little bit, and they had one that looked like really good hit on it. False positives, website blocking, seemed to be exactly the match. And there was a post that was pinned at the top, please read before posting possible false positive. And so I read that because it detailed information that they need in order to assess whether this was a false positive or not. And then I posted on there exactly what the issue was. And 43 minutes later, I got a reply back from one of the staff at MalwareVice saying the block will be removed. So I thought that was pretty cool in 43 minutes, and that definitely was fixed because of my reporting. So I felt particularly proud about that. Now, there's an insidious problem that can actually happen with vulnerabilities on computers. So if you have a product that happens to use an open source component as part of it, and there's lots of examples of this, and if a vulnerability is found in that open source component, and the open source component is fixed, that doesn't necessarily mean that the larger product that is using that component is actually going to update that fixed open source component. So can you update the insecure component? And I say maybe not, and actually probably not. I would not actually try to actually update that subcomponent. There may be some kind of dependencies of the way that it's installed that make it difficult or impossible to know that you're doing it correctly. So I would not entertain that. So what can you do? Complain. And so I've done this. And my control's not working.
Sorry, Mike. Okay, now.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so VolinDetect, when I was testing it out, it noticed that there is a vulnerability in OpenVPN.exe. Now, I never installed OpenVPN.exe. It was actually installed as part of TunnelBear, which is a VPN product that is available here in Canada. And I can see that it was obviously installed by TunnelBear because if I look where that openvpn.exe file is, it's under Program Files x86 TunnelBear, bins x64, and so forth. So it was obvious to me looking at that was installed as part of TunnelBear. So it's TunnelBear's responsibility, as far as I'm concerned, for them to fix this problem. So I checked for updates on the TunnelBear just in case I was running an older version and maybe it had already been fixed. Well, it turned out that I was using the latest update, so that didn't help me. So what do? I go to TunnelBear and I do a feedback on that. I think we lost Alan. Okay, just a second here. I'm going to switch over to sharing on my screen. Just a second. Sorry. Slideshow. And slideshow. Setup slideshow. In a kiosk. And okay, and if okay, let me just see if I can actually do this. I am getting problems sharing here. Okay, individual window. Here we go. This should work. Okay, and now I should be able to share this screen. Okay, now we're going to go jump forward a little bit more. Okay, so okay, there we go. So I reported that to TunnelBear through their feedback on their website. You know, all of the people who are selling products and that, they'll have some way of providing feedback on it. So I reported it, and it said that I should get a response within, I think they said, within 48 hours. Well, I actually got a response in under 13 hours, and there was actually a back and forth on it. So they first off wanted me to update to a newer version than they had available on their website, and I updated to it. There was no change at all. So they were just trying to put me off a little bit, I think. But then when I reported back saying, no, it's exactly the same problem, they said they took the time to ask the correct people, and it looks like they're in the process of actually updating this into the next release. Now, when the next release is going to come out, I don't know, because they say that they have a release freeze at the moment, trying not to break things before the end of the year. So it might be January before I actually see this fix, but at least they know about it. They've acknowledged that, yes, this is actually a problem. And so presumably in the next release for Tunnel Bear, they will distribute it with the newer version of OpenVPN.exe, and this vulnerability will go away. So it was worth reporting. So, and again, this is something that I think was fixed because of my reporting, because otherwise it might have stood around there for a long time. Who knows? Now, here's one where a follow-up might be to come. So another thing that Velen detected was a vulnerability in 7-Zip unzipping program. It's an archiving program. And again, I can see that it's not 7-Zip that did it. In this case here, it's under program data, NVIDIA Corporation. So it looks like it's part of my video drivers. So every time there's a new video driver comes out with NVIDIA, which typically once a month, then they will install something in there. And one of the things that they're including in that package is 7-Zip.exe. So I updated to the latest NVIDIA drivers, which happened to be released 2 weeks ago, and I ended up with the same version of 7-Zip.exe. So they didn't fix the problem in the latest drivers. So I reported it to NVIDIA, and I was told that I could expect a response within 24 hours. In actual fact, it was about 6-7 hours beyond that. Well, but the first response I got from them was basically saying, well, 7-Zip isn't our problem. It's another company's program, and it just does archives and things like that. So they didn't get the idea that, well, they installed it on my computer, and they installed an older version that had a security vulnerability. So I've reported back to them, again, that this is their issue, and they should not be distributing versions of 7-Zip that have security vulnerabilities, and I've yet to hear back from them on that. I'm presuming at this point I will hear back from them at some point saying that, oh, yes, we will update our video driver packages so that it uses a more up-to-date version of 7-Zip in there. So I expect that to actually come about at some point in the future.
Oh, by the way, I just saw a video on a 7-Zip bug that was reported and has been fixed. There's a YouTube video. I just put a link in the chat. But basically, it's a bug. It's very hard to exploit. It probably hasn't been exploited, but it it doesn't affect the regular zip files or even the 7-Zip protocol. It's some obscure protocol. But it's worthwhile to update to the latest 7-Zip.
Yeah. In actual fact, these vulnerabilities in open source components that have been added into your system, they probably would never be exploited. Because if I'm actively unzipping things and things like that, I'm not using that version of 7-Zip. If I install 7-Zip on my computer, it is actually going to be a separate install that I'll be running, and I do have control over updating that whenever I want. So these are probably components that are only going to be used by the particular program, such as NVIDIA when it's doing its installation of video drivers, or Tunnel Bear is using it. So, as you know, it's not any program that is going to actually access those executables. It's only going to be, in this case, TunnelBear or NVIDIA. So in actual fact, it's a very, very low likelihood of a problem. But I still think the company should not be distributing executables that have security vulnerabilities in them, that are known security vulnerabilities, that there's a fix for it. And they can update their software so that they are distributing software without security vulnerabilities. So I like to complain, and I think it's worthwhile for everybody to follow through on complaining to vendors when things aren't working as they should be. I see Alan is back.
Yeah, sorry about that. We had a power outage.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It knocked me off the internet completely. So.
Okay. Well, I'm glad it wasn't too long. Okay, just wrapping it up now, and we are just about at the 8:30, so I don't see anything. Oh, we have a question about Manypenny. When the comparison is displayed, does it only show the retail price, or will it display any given special, such as a flyer price? Bob, do you know?
I really don't know the answer to that one. I have seen it occasionally where I've seen a price in the store, and I say, that looks like a good price, and it's lower than everything. It's a really, they might have an in-store special, and I don't use it all the time, but I have seen some that are lower than everything. You might not look on your phone, have 7 prices on your phone, and this little deal really is a good price. Other times, though, they put a big display, and it's not a good price. So,
okay.
I don't know. I think if the sale price is the current store price, I would think it would be showing on my phone also. I believe that works. I haven't verified it exactly, but
okay.
It's free, it's handy, nothing to lose anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so just our wrap-up slides. We do have our one-on-one remote assistants. We've had 2 go through so far, successful in both instances. So, again, if you have something that can't easily be solved through something like a Q&A session, you can put in a request for a one-on-one remote assistance, and we'll try to match up somebody who's volunteered to provide assistance with you, and then you and that volunteer can work together on the on your request for assistance. Some of the upcoming presentations, the Ottawa Public Library, we've only got a few more in the calendar year. We do have another 25 that are currently set up for January through March. So those are available all on our website. They're not available for registration yet on the OPL website. But we do have these 3 that are coming up that are open for registration. And our next Q&A is going to be next week, December 4th. So send in your questions and your answers and topics you want covered and so forth to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And I think that's it, eh, Alan? Yeah. So thanks very much, folks, for showing up. It was, I think, a good session. We had a lot of material. And, again, if anybody has something that they want to share with the group, such as what Bob Harris did tonight, by all means, send in information about it, and we will reserve time for you at a Q&A.
Thanks, everyone.
Before we all go, if I could butt in, Tom posted the current updated version of 7-Zip in the chat, so I ran Patch My PC and checked my computer, and 7-Zip's up to date here, but I noticed there's an update since this morning for Glasswire, so the truly paranoid amongst us
Don't
want to go update their Glasswire program.
Yeah, Glasswire will update itself. It used to be that you had to manually update it. It'll update itself, but it's not real speedy on it. So you can be weeks before they actually offer you the update to Glasswire. I've been somewhat disappointed with them on that front. They should be a little bit more a little quicker on their updating of clients, I think.
Yeah, many are. I run Patch My PC twice a day, actually, and I catch things that way. Anyway.
Yeah, I am going to do a share at some point on Vuln Detect, or it might be long enough that I'll actually save it for a member's favorite night or something like that. But it's an interesting program. It has its quirks, but it seems to be pretty good about detecting most programs out there. So, still to come on that.
How do you update GlassWire? There doesn't seem to be a section in the settings.
Let me just check, because, yeah, they... let's see. The,
Chris said it does do it automatically at some point.
Yeah, it will do it, but there is a way of forcing it as well.
I just went to PC, and that utility forces the update.
Yeah.
The menus.
Say again?
I just run Patch My PC.
And it'll do it for you.
And it forces the update, and I don't have to dig through menus.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just trying to think here where it was. There is somewhere I found it, but it was not easy to find. It might have been that if you just go to the About, that it automatically checks for updates and tells you if there's one available at that point, but I'm not even 100% sure on that. You can always, if nothing else, get the version number from the About screen and check on their website, because their website is pretty front and center. It tells you the exact version on the homepage. It tells you what the version is that's current.
I may have mentioned Patch PC in an earlier Q&A, but at the time I'm sure I wasn't running the automatic updates. So that would actually be a really good share, Stuart. Hint, hint.
Yeah.
No, it's not automatic. I do it manually.
Well, manually, that would be a good share, Stuart. Hint,
hint. That would be a good share, yeah. I'm working on a couple other things that I have to actually use for a while before I can say anything. But I'm looking at an app that takes care of indoor plants for me.
Actually, that's interesting with GlassWire, because I'm currently at 3.4.694, and according to the website, 3.4.748 is current. So, yeah, they're not speedy about doing their automatic updates, and I was sure there was somewhere in here that you could actually force an update or force a check for updates, but I can't for the life of me find right now where that is. So, not good.
Go to the website and just download them.
Yeah, you can do it. It's just so much easier if you do it from within the program and just check for updates.
I'm like Bob. I like it simple.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. It's simple is always good. But yeah, I don't see anywhere in the program where I can say check for updates. Yeah, they have on the general tab, they have enable automatic version upgrades, but they don't have a button there say check now, and I don't know what their algorithm is for when they do automatic version upgrades, because I don't know how long it's been. I should probably actually check to see, now that I know it's out of date, see how long it is before they do an automatic update on my computer.
Hey, Chris? What did you say the current version was?
The current version on GlassWire is 3.4.748.
7.4. Oh, I got 6.94.
Yeah.
9.2.
Do I?
Yeah. So they're not doing very speedy updates, unless that just came out today or something like that. I don't know. But I should monitor that for a little while and put in a complaint about it as well, that they should be doing a better job of keeping things up to date.
Yeah, as I said, I run Patch My PC when I get up in the morning and before I go to bed, usually. And everything was fine this morning, but I just ran it now, and there's an update for GlassWire. So it's...
Okay. Yeah, actually, I think you're right that it is brand new, because if I look at Sectir Vuln Detect, the last run of it, it was showing, yeah, it's still showing that as being current, and I ran an update on it today. So it must have just come out today. Yeah, because it's not complaining about glassware right now. If I run another update, it probably would come up and tell me about. Oh, no, actually, they're not even monitoring glassware. Yeah, that's one of the things with Vulin Detect. They have a website where you can actually request additional apps to be monitored. And so I submitted four apps that are on my computer, Glasswire being one of them. And so I'm awaiting that being added to the list of apps that they will actually check for security vulnerabilities.
Hmm.
One of the things I like about Vulin Detect, though, is that they don't do feature updates. They don't care about that. They will consider it to be up to date if there are no security vulnerabilities. They'll tell you if there is a newer version, but they'll tell you it's okay from a security point of view. And so I'm fine with that. You know, I don't care as much about feature changes, but I do want to know when there's a security vulnerability and a patch is available.
Yeah, that's sort of the point of security update.
Yeah, exactly. I want a vulnerability manager, not an update manager.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, because I don't use 90% of the features in my programs anyway, so what the hell?
That's right. Why do you need yet another behavior change?
Yeah. Where'd my buttons go? What does this do?
Yeah. Okay, folks, thanks very much. We will see you next week.
Bye, everyone.